Bonus Podcast. I'm Max.
I'm Rich.
And on this podcast, we will be focusing on the Weird War Tales comic book series published by DC Comics from 1971 to 1983. On this episode in particular, we're going to be taking a look at Weird War Tales number 53. But first, Rich has a little something to say to you.
Not retroactive history, but personal news. Because I know you'd all want to know. Back in February, I got together with Army Retention and signed an indefinite contract extension. It's called an INDEF. This means I'm officially in the military until they throw me out or I retire, which would probably be sometime in 2031. I've got 13 years in, and it would be silly to get out now. I'm on the back nine, to use a golf phrase. Give me my pension! Moving on to the Intel report. Mouse by Art Spiegelman. A brutally moving work of art, widely hailed as the greatest graphic novel ever written. Mouse recounts the chilling experiences of the author's father during the Holocaust, with Jews drawn as wide-eyed mice and Nazis as menacing cats. Mouse is a haunting tale within a tale, weaving the author's account of his tortured relationship with his aging father into an astonishing retelling of one of history's most unspeakable tragedies. It is an unforgettable story of survival and a disarming look at the legacy of trauma. Yeah, we all know about this one. Every time this book pops up on some school's banned list, I immediately donate funds to have copies of that book sent to that area. You all know not to get me started. I originally had another book slotted here. I mean, I was always going to Intel Report Mouse at some point, but I decided to do some research to find out when concentration camps were liberated. On April 11th, 1945, U.S. forces liberated Buchenwald. This episode drops on April 10th, one day removed from the 79th anniversary of the liberation. My unit, the 104th Division, is listed as a liberating army unit by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum for Dora Mittelbau, a.k.a. Nordhausen. On that somber note, don't forget to go to the Intel Report album on the FB page and message us your selection for which story you want us to do a special mission on. Vote early, vote often. If there is a tie, we'll do a runoff.
Yeah, sure we will. I mean, how are you going to know the difference, right? So before we get into the issue at hand, I want to do something we haven't done in a while here on the show. We're going to run a little promo for another podcast here. Take a small podcast promo break. I know we haven't done it in a bit, but, you know, gosh darn it, I feel like today's special and we should do that. So sit back, relax, and take a listen to a little ad for another fantastic show out there on the interwebs that you should be totally listening to.
What do you get when a fantasy gaming horror sci-fi geek and an army veteran history nerd want to do a comic book related podcast?
Why, you get the Weird Warriors podcast, of course. Weird War Tales was a 124 issue DC comic book series published from 1971 to 1983.
Along the way, we'll sidetrack on to an occasional special mission where we discuss an issue of a like themed comic book from a different title or publisher.
There are also the rare Road Warriors episodes where we report on comic related road trips like conventions or visiting the homes and grave sites of comic greats.
We'll nitpick what the comics creative team got wrong and crow about what they got right. We'll also break down the facts behind the fiction in the stories, which is sometimes quite weird in its own right. Even the letters page and our favorite ads can't escape our judgment, just as we can't escape yours in our own dead letter office mailbag.
Torpedo-eating dinosaurs.
Haunted chateaus.
Time-traveling rats.
Zombie robots.
Day-walking vampires.
Gargoyle armies.
And that's just in the first 20 Weird War Tales episodes. So, report for duty with the Weird Warriors podcast with Max and Rich, where we promise to make war
no more.
And we're back. So, wasn't that awesome? That just sounds like the greatest show ever made. I mean, hey, it's our first episode after April Fool's Day. If we want to have a little more fun than usual, we're gonna. Okay? So, without any further ado, now that you have a new favorite show to go check out, Rich, is going to hit you with that cover detail for Weird War Tales number 53.
Art by first timer and Batman icon Jim Aparo. 30 cents. Weird War Tales is blue on an orange sky. Two dead Americans lie in the foreground, one's eyes still open and vacant. His yellow-tinged spirit rises from the body, aiming his bayoneted rifle at Death, who is dressed in the uniform of an enemy officer and riding a skeletal horse. Behind Death charges the ghosts of soldiers from multiple eras. Death points at the American ghost and bellows, "You tried to escape your fate, but no man is beyond the reach of death." Cover date, May 1977. Date of release, February 8th, 1977. Killjoy. Joe Kubert played the same game on the cover of Weird War Tales 5, where a U.S. soldier about to be hung by the Germans is sporting a name tape on his uniform. And Adams, a nod to Neil, of course. A, it's on the wrong side of the blouse. U.S. Army is above the heart. And B, we didn't have name tapes on our uniforms during World War II. But I give a coy nod to Aparo by signing the cover by putting his own name there.
Yeah, leave nothing to chance. Jim did everything on his art duties, by the way. He normally did his own coloring, his own lettering, everything. So it doesn't shock me at all that he found a way to sneak a signature into the cover. And speaking of the cover, I'm going to give, I'm going to kick off the comments and commendations on said cover. And let me just say, I'm well known in my circles as a huge fan of Jim Aparo's Batman. Aparo's Batman is the Batman I see when I close my eyes, followed only even kind of closely by Dick Giordano's rendition of the character. I've read every issue of Brave and the Bold with Aparo art in it that I could get my grubby little hands on. Batman and the Outsiders with Aparo art, with Aparo on art duties, count me in. Aparo on literally anything, give me a copy of that. That all being said, this cover ain't great. The massive void of flatly colored empty space on the left side sends your eyes rushing to the right for some stimulation, and what it finds instead is mostly confusion and disappointment. The sketchy-looking specters shambling through the yellow cloud in the background are too sketchy-looking for a finished piece of cover work, and Death himself looks like he's riding the skeleton of a horse that's about the size of a large dog. Problems of scale jump out at me again with the ghost that's rising from the fallen soldier. The spectral form might match up in dimensions to the body it's left behind, but its proximity to the drawing of the other fallen soldier in the foreground just makes things look strangely mismatched. It's a tangent problem, people. Look it up. The poor casualties that I've just talked about and kind of denigrated are the best drawn parts of the cover, but they're just surrounded by everything else that just looks dashed out by my much admired Jim Aparo. So see, I can be hard on my favorites, people. It can happen.
We unfortunately only see Aparo on two covers of Weird War Tales and never inside the book. We have to wait till issue 105 for his next and last appearance when he does a Creature Commandos cover. I really, really want to like this, but I think the colorist did Aparo dirty. Yellow ghosts on an orange sky with a blue title? Ick. I like the images of the dead GIs, especially Aparo's open-eyed corpse. But the rest of it? Max said it much better than me. Hate to say it, but overall, this is a failing grade.
Yeah, sad, but according to the two of us, true. So let's move beyond that cover and take a look at what we see when we open this issue. And what we are treated to is a full-page introduction. And script for this is by Bob Rozakis. Art is, and I'll get into this later, supposedly by Jerry Taliak. Synopsis of what we're looking at here is in front of a blood-red sky with a bony finger extended, the helmeted visage of Death knocks over a row of skull-decorated dominoes towards four GIs that flee in the foreground. Behind them, a German tank and infantry pursue down a shell-blasted hill. And Death says, I am Death, the ultimate end of the unending circle of life. And this is the weird war, the unending battle of man against man, good against evil, and opinion against opinion, for reasons that matter not. For as sure as these soldiers behind you fall, so shall you into my waiting hands. Hear the roar? Hear the blasting of the rifles and cannons? It is the music of the Weird War. This portion of the Weird War was called World War II by the men who fought it. They battled for countries and tried to defeat fate. But their destiny was of their own making, falling upon them like deadly domino.
I don't see any killjoy there, except for what Max is about to get into. So I'll just lunge into the CNC. And as you all know, I write my portions of the script before Max does. So, you know, I knew not what Max is about to say when I wrote this. Jerry T rules the roost. His representation of Death here strikes all the cylinders. My best call out is the angle of perspective. The Americans are running from the attacking Germans, obviously, but the way the dominoes are falling and the direction they're looking, an argument could certainly be made that the GIs are dodging them as well. Okay, you have my attention. What are you going to do with it? Why, you're going to continue the intro panel into the first page of the actual story where our deathly narrator keeps talking as the GIs turn and destroy the enemy tank that had been chasing them. We haven't seen that since the reprint issues. Number 4's Ghost Ship of Two Wars, most notably. Well done.
Yeah, in case I didn't make that clear in my enthusiastic reading of the Death intro, I go from that first intro page into the opening splash panel of the first story in Death's voice there when he says, hear the roar. I'm in the first story. Like, Rich is right. The drawing is nothing to be sneezed at. It's excellent. I freaking love the intro page and the panel it leads into. I just want to say, from my little contrarian CNC, I know that the Grand Comics database says this page was drawn by Jerry Taliak, but I don't think that's the case. Granted, the GCD has a question mark by his name for inks, but I don't even see another inker being able to change Jerry T's style this much in the finishing stage. It's just too basic. Like, I don't want to insult the art here again. It's well done. But in terms of layout, figure work, the simple floating skeletal hand of Death connected to nothing, and the overall toy playset look of things, which again is cool and works, and I'll tell you why in a sec here. It's just not, Jerry doesn't draw stuff this grounded in a kind of simple, formalized reality. So, you know, it just, I think they got this one wrong. I'd say that this all does look like it could have been put together by a very young Herb Trimpe, who is another massively favorite artist of mine. And it gives me good vibes in the coming pages, spoiler alert, in that vein too. But Jerry Taliak, no chance. I'm saying no chance. That aside, this is effective on its own merits. And I especially like the inclusion of opinion against opinion for reasons that matter not in Death's intro speech, putting a real fine point on the pointlessness of human conflict. And yes, the fact that this piece, as I said, does lead directly into the opening story is super sweet. Thumbs up, but this is just not Taliak's work. I say bleh. So we're leading into our first story here, and I am gonna let Rich officially kick it off, even though I already sort of edged in there as Death. But we're gonna stick to some format here. You know, we're an orderly people. So first story is what?
I think it's called Deadly Dominoes. 6 pages. Script by Jack C. Harris. Pencils by first timer number 2, Juan Ortiz. Inks by last timer number 1, Tex Blaisdell. Now, brace yourself. This is going to get nuts by episode end, by the way. Synopsis. It's the cover story and the intro page tie-in. This better be one hell of a tale with this much buildup. Somewhere in the ETO, two men hunker down in a forward foxhole. Corporal Curtis doesn't like the assignment. He's only going to look out for number one. The Sergeant Curtis is sharing the hole with briskly tells him that he can look out for himself while he does his job. A potato masher suddenly lands on the ground beside Curtis, and the sergeant yells a warning. Curtis scoops it up and hurls it away before it explodes. "You did it, Corporal!" the sergeant exclaims. "You saved my skin! All your number one talk's just a lot of hot air!" "No, Sarge, I only saved you because you happen to be here. I'm the master of my own fate. I was saving myself. If I go, it won't be anyone's fault but my own." Curtis raises his rifle and fires two random rounds towards the enemy. "Every time I fire this baby, I shoot for Corporal Curtis. And who can say I didn't wipe out the one German soldier who was about to blow me away?"
"Yes, but the fates work for me too, Corporal. And though you try to twist your fate, death wins in the end."
Curtis is instantly killed when a shell explodes directly in front of him. His ghost stands behind death, and they both watch the Sarge cradle Curtis's head in his hands. "Guess I was wrong. Fate can get you any time. It's out of your hands."
"No, my boy. You're right. Although I got you, your fate was still your own. Observe."
Time resets, and Curtis watches how his fate had unfolded.
"Observe the path of the last bullet you fired across this blood-stained battlefield as it finds its fateful mark."
The .30-06 round slams into the chest of a German machine gunner, killing him. The gunner's finger locks on the weapon's trigger.
"He falls, and his weapon utters its fiery words in my name, at his own comrades. 4 seconds after you fired your shot, 4 Germans joined me and waited for you. And as the living often do, they called for those departed."
At a German camp miles away, a radioman reports to the commander that there's no response from the machine gun on Hill 66. "The Americans must have advanced and overtaken them," he responds. "Radio the west flank. Advance!"
And so they went forward into my grasp. Before them, death. And behind them, the future dead.
German tanks and infantry advance on Hill 66. One of the infantrymen is carrying a Panzer Schreck anti-tank weapon. He trips on one of the bodies on the hilltop and falls. The forward grip of the tube hits the ground hard and causes the weapon to fire. A rocket howls out of the muzzle, heading for the foxhole Curtis and the sergeant rest in, and explodes.
"The arcing missile completes the perpetual cycle you began, and the circle closes."
The sergeant lowers Curtis to the ground, picks up his rifle, and begins to sweat as he peers out towards the enemy lines.
"For now, at least. But what of the next circle? Will the firing of the next bullet be his salvation? Or will his hesitation for that fateful second spell his doom? Which will it be? And does it matter in the end?"
Killjoy! Page 3, panel 5, the German machine gun looks like a water-cooled one with butterfly grips. I did some research on those for an earlier story, and they don't appear to exist. And, of course, the miscolored Nazi armband, page 4, panel 4.
"Of course. I mean, they put those things in there just for you at this point." So, kicking off the CNC, I gotta say, this story kicks things off with a pretty good intro panel and logo. And I really like the effort put into the host's narrative script throughout the story. Not just because I read those parts in our script. Honest. The music of the weird war, indeed. In and around panel 2 of the first page, I like the way the aforementioned narrative caption work is set up outside of the panel borders, too. On panel 4, though, the arrival of the brightly colored grenade almost comically falls flat for me. However, on page 2, dang, wholly Jack Kirby and John Buscema inspired layouts. More room for sound effects and action. On panel one alone, the previously, in my opinion, pitiful grenade is more than redeemed by its positively 3D portrayal. And panel five scratches the itch that the intro page to this issue had me grasping for. The drawing of the Sarge, again, panel five there, all but proves that Juan Ortiz drew the intro page, not Jerry Tolayac. The style on display throughout these pages should be enough too, but it would sure explain how that page so tightly tied into this tale, huh? Anyway, the out-of-the-border caption work is still really effective on this page as well. And of course, just as I'm getting into a stylistic groove with the story, page three shakes it all up with a pretty much complete change in the overall layout and design philosophy. The captions, panel designs, everything just shifts really hard. It's not bad, mind you, but it did make me blink pretty hard, which I think was the intent. Panel one, although, feels weirdly empty, and it isn't at all clear to me, at least at first, that Curtis's ghost is standing with Death in the background. Little wobble there for me. But panels two through four, showing the path of the bullet, are pretty great, very visually energetic and eye-catching. And then on page four, panel two, we get a nice and clearly labeled Nazi tent for Rich, which I'm assuming was historically accurate because it wasn't called out in the Killjoy. And the work, we'll see about that. And the work in panel six, again, gives me a very proto Herb Trimpe vibe, which puts me in a good mood, people, I gotta say. I'm a simple guy. Page five returns us to a very Kirby-like layout, especially in the framing of the figures in panel three. The oddly chosen close-up focus right there adds to the feeling of chaos on the page. And on the final page, panel one kicks things off with a far too cartoonish-looking whoosh for my taste on the incoming Rocket of Death. And I feel page six fails to signal to the reader in that final panel that it's the actual end of the story, even with the excellent narrative captions trying to help things along. I guess I had a lot to say about this one. It's really good stuff, even though it sounds like I picked at a lot of it.
This is at least the second time the term number one has popped up in these pages. And not surprisingly, both of them came off as selfish jerks before buying it. The term itself apparently goes back to at least 1835, according to a Reddit poster. It doesn't seem to be used that often anymore, however, even in toilet humor. I really like this story, and having Max keep doing the narrator's voice was automatic. You know, kind of what we did for the TV in that mass shooter story, Looking Good, Feeling Great, in the 1997 redeployment issue of Weird War Tales 2. It's a nice touch, makes it easier to craft. That said, there's a huge temporal trip in panels four and five of page two, where Curtis fires his rifle and then is apparently immediately killed in an explosion. Fave panels, page three panels one through four of Curtis meeting Death and Death showing Curtis the path of his fateful bullet through the trees. And page six panels four through six, the slow close in of the sergeant as he sweats out what's next. And to add to Max's point about the Nazi tent, yeah, that definitely could have been a Killjoy, since that's a classic comic case of, look, bad guys! I've walked through dozens of German encampments reenacting, and I've never seen a tent with a big old swastika on it like that. Kind of gives the enemy an aiming point besides. I'm going to take the next story because the first one was a team effort. It's one of our favorites, ladies and gents. Day after Doomsday, coming back around. Two pages. Script by first-timer number three, Paul Kupperberg. Pencils by first-timer number four. And last-timer number two, Jeff Acklin. Inks by last-timer number three, Bob Wiechek. This getting confusing yet? When the first bombs fell in Washington, D.C., and Moscow, you were heading down an elevator shaft to a spot almost a mile beneath the Earth's surface, oblivious to the destruction taking place over your head. It wasn't until the Earth around you began to tumble that you realized you might not live to see the day after Doomsday. You look around the ruin that was once West Virginia, and you are scared. There didn't seem to be anything left alive. gone. And you are responsible for dozens of deaths yourself. You had barricaded yourself in a small airtight compartment after the poisonous gases had filled the mine. You stayed there long after the screams for help and the desperate pounding on the door had ceased. You let men die. You had to, you tell yourself. You cannot open the door and let the noxious fumes get you too. You knew it would happen one day. You knew those damned fool politicians would one day drop the bomb. So you took precautions. You search frantically through the wreckage that was once your home. You look for a sign, any sign of life. The bomb shelter. Annie and the children must have made it to safety of the shelter you had wisely built years ago. It was the latest in bomb shelters. 2-inch thick lead walls, rations for 3 months, separate power generator, everything, including an electronically controlled door that hermetically sealed off the bomb-proof chamber. The door opens and you rush in, unaware that the heavy lead door has closed, sealing you in. That smell, like the gas that seeped into the mine, threatening to do what the bombs had not succeeded in doing. Maybe it was the shockwaves from the first bombs that caused the gas line to burst. Maybe faulty construction. You don't dwell on the reason. And as your lungs fill with the poisonous gas, you stare at the still forms of your wife and children. Dead. Just like the men in the mine. Because of you. No Killjoy. Hop to the CNC. Bob Wajcik only appeared in 2 issues of WWT, and I got him to sign them both. Another great DA detail, a timeless one of karma killing someone in the same way that person had caused others to die. 2 call-outs, 1 per page. The splash panel of the survivor digging his way out of the mine with the title resting on the dirt. And page 2, panel 1, the shadows and colors seen as the survivor arrives at his devastated home.
Yeah, so here we got another guy. Looking out for number 1, 2 in a row, except, and maybe I missed this, but this guy doesn't pay the ultimate price for his selfish behavior. Everyone else does instead. Sure, grief is a price, but it ain't death. I mean, you want to see this guy get his comeuppance, and maybe his wife was a piece of work too. But you got to cut the kids some slack, eh? The art did the job with the space it had. It didn't blow me away, but it told the story clearly and interestingly, unless I was confused about him dying in the last panel. Overall, still not bad. Continuing Day After Doomsday's completely redeemed streak in this magazine.
Well, yeah, the last panel. It says, as your lungs fill with the poisonous gas. Because he's sealed in the gas chamber. So, yeah, he's checking out.
Oh, okay, so at least he died too. Yeah.
Screw you.
Who said all this involved reading and comprehension? So yeah, well, he dies. I still say, you know, maybe we could have left the kids out of it, but you know, they weren't really in control of their own fate. So
war is hell.
Yeah, war is hell. War is hell, and everybody dies. You know, happy April Fool's Day kind of episode thing. So here we go, folks. We're heading into a long one. And you got me at the steering wheel. I hate to tell you. At least it's the last story in the issue. It's called Something to Die For. It's 8 pages long. Script is by stalwart Jack Olek. Pencils are by legendary Ernie Chan. Inks by first-timer number 5. And last-timer number 4, Wayne Howard. More about him later. Synopsis of the story, however, starts out like this. Peru, 1532. Usually, the conquistadors of Captain Francisco Pizarro, that's Pizarro, not Bizarro, even though it's a DC comic, had driven the Incas before them like chaff. But on this day, they ran out of powder for the cannon. The Indios would soon overwhelm the Spaniards without it, so Pizarro was forced to order a retreat. In the mad gallop back to their supply base at Zatlan, Juan Perez and Santiago are separated from the others. Perez is a mercenary. He had come to this miserable country for gold, not to be buried. Under a pitiless blazing sun, the strength was drained from man and beast alike. After only a day, Santiago's horse collapses in desperate need of water. Perez refuses to give the horse time to recover and pulls out a whip to get the beast moving again. Santiago seizes Perez's wrist as the whip flies back to strike. It isn't the horse's fault. Soft-hearted I may be, but there's no reason to beat an animal that's done its best for me. Glancing over Santiago's shoulder, Perez sees an Indio hiding in the rocks, watching them, knowing that if there was water anywhere nearby, the Indio would know where it is. Perez tells Santiago to continue nursing his horse and keep the Indian's attention. Perez would sneak around behind and capture him, which, with the strike of the butt of a wheel-lock pistol, was done. Dragging his captive into the open, Perez threatens the Indio with his blade. "We need water. Do you take us to it, or do I tickle your eyes with my sharp little toy here?" Santiago immediately objects. "His eyes? No, we are not savages. You wouldn't. Would you rather your bones bleach in the sun? What does one more Indio matter?" But the terrified Indio complies. There's a spring a half day's march away, and he leads them to it. It was the limit of endurance for the Spaniards and their mounts. Drinking his fill, Perez sees in the water's reflection the gold necklace that the native wears. He'd been too thirsty to notice before. Perez jumps up and tears it off the Indio's neck. "Where did these come from? Where are your minds? Tell me, you cursed heathen, before I tear the tongue from your head." Again, Santiago intercedes. "Stop it! There will be no senseless killing and no torture. I won't let..." But Perez had had enough of Santiago's interference by now and pulls out his pistol. "You sniveling old woman! Very well. Until now I've endured your stupid softness, but now..." Now it was the Indio's turn to protest. "No, I beg you, no, do not shoot. The white man has been good to me. I will lead you to one of our mines, but do not hurt him." The native is good to his word and leads the two conquistadors to a nearby mine, but out of gratitude also gives them a warning. "Please do not enter. Our wise men have set a curse on our mines. Any white man who enters is doomed." Harris sneers at the warning. "Doomed by the curse of some half-naked mongrel Indio? Thank you, my friend. You've been most helpful. But now we have no further need of you." Pulls out his knife and rams it into the Indio's back, killing him. "Murderer!" Santiago explodes. "There was no need for that. Pizarro will hear of this when we get back to Zatlan. Perez is here for gold, as am I. He cares no more for the Indios than I do. But you will not be going back to Zatlan." Perez pulls out his pistol and shoots Santiago. "Why should I share my treasure with you? I've made up my mind on the way here that what gold we found will be mine alone." By the light of a torch, Perez descends into the mine. There is no gold, but a fortune in silver. Perez's joy is boundless, and he loads his saddlebags to overflowing with the loot. All he has to do upon returning to Zatlan is tell Pizarro that Indios had killed Santiago. But the Indios feared horses, thinking them monsters. I mean, their heads are pretty big. It's kind of spooky. If they killed Santiago, they would have killed his horse too. So, Perez callously guns down the murdered Spaniard's mount, leading his own horse back to Zatlan, because I guess he needed one. The ghostly image of Santiago atop his steed materializes on the trail in front of Perez. Terrified, Perez runs, and Santiago pursues. Many leagues disappear under his feet, but when next he has the courage to look, the ghost is gone. Had it been an illusion? The mounted ghost appears in front of Perez again, rearing his horse. Perez fires his pistol at the specter, and it vanishes yet again. For the rest of the trek back to Zatlan, Perez was a man half mad with terror. Pizarro and the Padre are the first to see him arrive and are pleasantly surprised. They thought for sure the Indios had gotten him. Perez eagerly reaches into his saddlebags and shows the two men the treasure and silver he had found. But at that moment, the mounted ghost of Santiago appears again. Perez is the only one who sees it. "No! Get away! Get away from me!" Perez screams. "You're dead! Go back to hell!" To the others, it was as if Perez had gone mad. He was trying to get away from something, but there was nothing there. Only Perez sees the ghostly horse rear up and kick him square in the face. Perez drops dead. Somehow, a hoof mark appears on his face where there hadn't been one before. What had happened? It was a puzzle that would never be solved. It was sad, though. The Padre mused. He had died for nothing. Pizarro doesn't understand. What about the silver? The holy man picks up one of the lumps of silver that Perez had been holding, as the ghost of Santiago observes from a distant hilltop. His silver is a worthless white metal for which no European has even found a use. Trash! The Indios named it for the river in which they mine it. The Platino del Pinto, they call it. Or platinum. Of the end.
History minute. Financial one. As with the history of gold, the history of platinum begins with the ancient Egyptians, who more than 3,000 years ago created gold jewelry with traces of platinum. The gold was not alloyed with platinum intentionally, however. It was more likely just a natural component of the ores the Egyptians imported from Nubia. On the other side of the world, around 100 BC, native South Americans used platinum to create metal nose rings and other items for ceremonial purposes. When the Spanish conquistadors swept the land searching for gold in the 16th century, they paid little attention to platinum, which they considered an inferior metal because it was difficult to melt and work with. The Spanish christened it Platina del Pinto, meaning little silver of the Pinto River, after the location in Colombia where it was first found. In 1557, an Italian-French scientist, Julius Caesar Scaliger, analyzed the new metal and discovered it was not silver as originally suspected. This failed to cause much of a stir, though, and platinum was more or less forgotten for the next 200 years. In the mid-18th century, platinum was rediscovered by the Spanish scientist Antonio de Ulloa. It soon became an object of great interest to European alchemists, who were interested in transforming base metals into gold. When Swedish scientist Theophil Schaeffer declared platinum a precious metal in 1751, the stage was set for the metal's meteoric rise from obscurity to object of desire. In 1783, a French chemist named François Cabanot discovered the means to purify platinum. In 1788, some of Cabanot's curious new metal was used to make the famous chalice of Pope Pius VI. In the early 1800s, Englishman William Hyde Wollaston and Smithson Tennant discovered how to make platinum malleable, effectively opening the door to platinum's extensive commercial applications. Platinum was discovered in Russia in 1822, and shortly thereafter, it began to be fashioned into decorative chains. By the 1850s, platinum cufflinks and shirt studs could be found, but technology did not yet exist to pull the metal into fine wires or form intricate shapes. Although prized by connoisseurs, platinum remained fairly obscure until the 1890s, when Cartier in France and Tiffany & Co. in New York began using platinum in fine jewelry. One of the biggest challenges for jewelry manufacturers was platinum's extremely high melting point, approximately 3,200 degrees Fahrenheit. At the time, new high-temperature blowtorches and shaping techniques were just being introduced in the jewelry industry, giving jewelers the means to heat and fashion platinum into elaborate but lightweight designs. As a result, platinum jewelry became status symbols during the Edwardian period at the beginning of the 20th century. Platinum was also popular in the 1920s and 30s, especially during the Art Deco period. It became the preferred metal for engagement and wedding rings because it does not alter the perceived color of diamonds and is much, much stronger than silver.
There you have it, folks. And anyone who's a fan of DC Comics, The Metal Men, probably already knew that thing about the melting point of platinum, because platinum, the female member of the Metal Men, that's one of the things they would always repeat in every adventure, was like little facts like, besides, I have an extremely high melting point, blah, blah, blah. And they would get it approximately right every time. So that's one thing that even comic book nerds would have had drilled into their heads if they were Metal Men fans. So that awesome history minute aside, I'll kick off the CNC, and I'm going to warn you folks, this is going to be another long one from me. The short version of this long CNC is I freaking love this one. Why, you ask? Well, let's make my entire case by directing you to look at that entire first page. It's freaking awesome. I'm sorry, but when you turn to see this thing after reading the rest of the issue, it's like a kick in the face. Get it? The whole thing just has some very strong Gold Key Classics Illustrated and Charlton Comics vibes, all in the very best ways. And did I mention Charlton Comics vibes? Now, why would I say Wayne freaking Howard? Hold the phone. I'm not sure if I've raved about Mr. Wayne Howard on the show before, but you should know how much something like that matters to me by now. In a rare show of mercy, however, I'll be as reductive as possible about it all and read to you from the Midnight Tales portion of Wayne Howard's Wikipedia entry. Now, the series, Midnight Tales, was Wayne Howard's most notable legacy, was providing the precedent for comic book created by credits, which became common years later, beginning with DC's Vertigo imprint a couple of decades later. Charlton writer-editor Nicola Cuddy described Howard's credit for the horror anthology Midnight Tales being granted, since it was his idea, his concept, his everything. In the series, all of this ranged from horror host Professor Coffin, the Midnight Philosopher, and his niece, Arachne, who, in a twist on the horror host convention, would themselves star in a story each issue, to the notion of having each issue be themed. All of this came from Wayne Howard. One time it would be blob monsters, and I wrote three stories about blob monsters, and another time it was vampires, and that sort of thing, said Howard. He penciled and inked every cover and virtually every story in the series, and occasionally even scripted the tales rather than just plotting them. The three-issue reprint series, Professor Coffin, number 19 to 21, from October 1985 to February 1986, retained the created by credit. Again, this series was the first to carry a credit like that in the front, dedicated to one creator in the series. Charlton just, they did what they wanted at Charlton Comics, for one thing. And, you know, Nicola Cuddy just decided, this is Wayne's book, we're going to call it Wayne's book. So the critic Mark Andrew observed of the Midnight Tales series, you got an old dude and his sexy niece traipsing around the countryside, bumping into oddball characters who invariably have a story to tell. Sadly, since Charlton didn't want to do anything that would offend your average nine-year-old, you can feel this book fighting against the uber-restrictive comics code. Kind of sad, really. What is good, however, are the artists in the book easily the equal of anyone working at Marvel or DC at the time. You got Wayne Howard, probably the most deft practitioner of the Wally Wood school ever. And you can see that in that splash page. Even though it's Ernie Chan pencils, you can see those inks. And you can see that Wally Wood school of delineation, of shadowing and everything. Wayne Howard's awesome. Sadly, however, Wayne passed away far too soon at the age of 58 in 2007 in Derby, Connecticut, which was the home of his beloved Charlton Comics headquarters. So that certainly explained the extra oomph behind the Ernie Chan artwork on that opening page for me, because I'm a Charlton Comics fiend, people. I have every issue of Midnight Tales. It's one of my favorite of the Charlton Comics horror series, and that's saying something. And it's just a notch above. And that creator consistency and talent is part of what gets it there. But speaking of that opening page, how about I do a little talking about this actual story? Fine. On page two, I want to call out the nice and comic booky blue coloring of the soldier in the foreground, much like Perez's horse in the opening panel on page one. You know I love when colorists use the full range of effects at their disposal instead of just leaning on drab realism, folks. The way zoomed out shot of Perez and Pal's retreat in panel three is really fun. And in panel five, we get that bad guy shows signs of cruelty to animals that you all know makes me start sharpening my knives for said bad guy. Page three plays nicely with the whole injury to eye taboo from the infamous origins of the Comics Code Authority. So, little shot at those guys there. Followed by a simply great contrast to all of that gruesomeness with a lovely pastoral scene in panel six. Just a great page all around. The shifts in perspective from panels one through four on page four are masterful. All once again followed by a lovely pastoral panorama in panel five. Page five brings us our chance to do our Daffy Duck voices with panel four's I'm rich. No, you're not. You're Paris.
And I'm rich.
He's rich. We say it right at the top of the show. Panel five. Oh, it's the final nail in the F you buddy coffin for Perez. When you gun down a poor innocent horse. Page six has a nice spot of silhouette work in panel one, which I always like to see. And panel three's oversized flea in 3D effect is done really well too. Page seven brings us all the Shakespearean shades of Macbeth that an English major like me could want. While page eight starts off in panel one with an almost too comical looking hoof to the face shot. And the twist that it was only platinum that Perez had stolen was pretty nice too. So I liked it.
I don't know a whole lot about the conquistador period, other than the fact that I know it was a shameful page of human history. Spoiler alert, I'm one of those bleeding hearts of things at the very least Columbus Day should be renamed. This is the timeless tale of some greedy piece of garbage that will stop at nothing to become rich, only to discover that his so-called treasure is worthless. We've seen a few stories like that in this series, like Spoils of War from WWT 39. Calling the native a heathen and his chief a half-naked mongrel only rapidly increases the loathing you have for him. Of course, Perez has no qualms about murdering his native sympathizing animal-loving buddy. The fact that it was Santiago's horse that ended up snuffing this guy out makes the vengeance from beyond the grave twist all the sweeter. Chan and Howard team up to craft a gem here. I got a little bit of a Prince Valiant vibe. The detail work and the uniforms is first rate. Page 6, panel 3 is one example. But I have to deduct a tenth of a point on the colorist making the hoof mark on Perez's face green in the last panel of the story. Almost any other color would work better there. And another tenth of a point for the colorist flubbing the assignment on the splash panel. Throughout the story, whenever the ghost of Santiago shows up, he and his horse are blue and black. But on the splash panel, he's colored like he's still alive. I like page 3, panel 1 of Santiago restraining Perez from beating his horse for, you know, a variety of reasons. So, what's next? APO Weird War Tales. And before we lunge into the individual letters, we're going to go into a little bit of an intro paragraph they have here. How would you like to win a free subscription to Weird War Tales? Okay, now that we have your attention, here's all you have to do to win. It's easy, honest. Rate the stories in this issue in the order that you like them. Your favorite story first, and so on. Send in your list, preferably with a letter of comment so we know why you liked or disliked the stories. And leave the rest to us. We'll tabulate the results and see what stories the majority of your readers feel are best, second best, and so on. See Molly. The winner will be picked from those readers whose results match or come closest to the majority. So come on and send your cards and letters to the Weird War Poll Contest and win yourself a free sub. And now on to the regularly scheduled letters. See, folks, just as we're initiating our second annual fan-voted episode, Joe and Co. are doing the same. Great minds, I tell you. Anyway, my letter comes from Ed Gores, no address given. Dear Joe, I've really got to hand it to you guys. Weird War Tales number 49 was the best darn issue of the book since I don't know when. It all started when I spotted that beautiful sparkling Coletta cover on the newsstand, hidden amongst all the other comic books. I figured that any comic with such a gorgeous cover had to be a surefire winner. And brother, was I right. From Face of the Enemy to Mark of the Conqueror, it was a beaut. Jack Olick turned in another fantastic war tale with the first story. It's always nice to see a weird story that relies not on the supernatural or the macabre, but on simple irony to make it work. Leo Durinona was another element that made the Face of the Enemy work. Good Lord, can that man draw. A Right to Die was incredibly powerful for a three-pager. But then one comes to expect a story of that caliber from a writer of the caliber of George Kashtan. His mystery stuff has always been superlative, but it's his war stories that have made me a real Kashtan fan. I don't have to tell you what I think of Ricardo Villamonte's art. Then again, I think I will. It's superb! The Day After Doomsday has always been something that I've looked forward to in every issue of Weird War. The Skeets Ditko Coletta collaboration in this issue was just another in a series of fantastic TDAD. Finally, Mark of the Conqueror was yet another Olick opus. Between the script and the Chua drought art, this story was just about my favorite in the whole issue. Let's get more of this team a lot more often. And there's no response to that other than my response to that. And it's like, hey, Jason Zeller, I did not give you permission to steal my time machine. This is so obviously you. I don't know what to say. Just ask next time, man, for Pete's sake. Gah!
I mean, maybe he did ask, but he asked you in the future. Hard to tell, you know? From my letter, I choose the only other letter left in the column. Who says things ain't easy and easy? So that letter starts out with, guess what? Dear Joe, I'm a longtime fan of Weird War Tales, a military buff, and an avid reader of Weird War Tales. Well, this is a good place for him then. I prefer science fiction stories, but I certainly don't mind the other Weird War stories that you publish. I'm against D. Kelly's suggestion that Weird War Tales should feature a regular character. By doing that, you'd be stifling creativity by forcing the writers and artists to stick to one basic idea and character. The way WWT is now, you're able to feature a diversity of characters, situations, and wars. Leave it the way it is. When are you going to come out with a giant-sized collector's issue of Weird War Tales? It's a good question. And that question came from Ronnie Levy of South Lake, Texas, 76051. Now, Joe responds to Ronnie. He says, fear not, Ronnie. There are no plans to give Weird War Tales a regular character. Not for a long time, anyway. If you're looking for giant-sized war action, bet you can smell a plug coming up. Ah, good old Joe. Don't miss GI Combat with 80 pages of all new material on sale each and every month. So there you go. Just a nice, positive fan letter. You know, and mostly, you know, just wanting the book to stay the way it is and all that and enjoying it. It's nice. It's nice to experience something like that in fandom. When we're mired in these modern days of, oh, that movie's going to tank, yeah, blah, I hate everything, but I won't stop watching it, blah, blah, blah. So good on you, Ronnie Levy. Good on you for keeping the positivity flag in the air. So now, we've got the letters page done, the stories are done. You know what comes next, people? It's our spotlighted ads for this issue. And once again, and in honor of, and perhaps as an apology to one of our featured creators from this issue of Weird War Tales, I got to go with a selection from the Daily Planet insert of DC Comics House Ad News in this issue. And the two features I'm going to call out, first of all, again, to make it up to our cover artist, headline reads, Sea King Battles Starfish from Space. The article was posted from the ocean floor. It has been a number of years since Aquaman and his fellow Justice Leaguers battled the giant starfish from space, Starro the Conqueror. It was way back in their first recorded adventure in Brave and Bold, number 28, trivia buffs. Now, as a result of pollutants in the ocean waters, a small piece of Starro's body has regenerated into a brand new version, more powerful and deadlier than the original. Can the King of the Sea hope to defeat this menace without the aid of his super compatriots? Learn The Secret of the Sinister Abyss by David Michelinie and Jim Aparo in Adventure Comics number 451. And it says also in this issue, which goes on sale this week of February 14th, happy Valentine's Day, John Johns, Manhunter from Mars, searches for the killer of a friend in a Denny O'Neill, Mike Nasser, Terry Austin tale that's a Martian Manhunter story. Woohoo! But over on the right of this column is an awesome picture of, yes, a giant starfish with an eye in the center of its body, blasting the heck out of Aquaman's head with ray beams from two of its arms. And it's just a great Jim Aparo drawing. Even at thumbnail size, this thing is just awesome. This is comics right there, people. So a little bit of a tip of the hat to Jim with some art on the inside, really tiny, that shows you why I fell in love with this guy's art in the first place. Especially, I mention his Batman all the time, but his Aquaman was the first, you know, time I ever bothered to read Aquaman, was I saw how he was drawing him in Adventure Comics, and that got my attention. Beneath that is an ad for another, and I got to squeeze another one in here, you know, is another little article and ad for the Freedom Fighters Clash with Crusaders from Niagara Falls. From out of the pages of an old comic book, the Crusaders came, Americamando and Rusty, Fireball and Sparky, and the Barracuda, their mission to defeat and capture the fugitive freedom fighters. Just who are these heroes and what will be the result of their battle with Uncle Sam, the Human Bomb, the Ray, Black Condor, Phantom Lady, and Doll Man? The answers await you, along with D-Day at Niagara, when Bob Rozakis, Dick Ayers, and Jack Abel team up for Freedom Fighters number 8 on sale this week of February 14th. Now, the reason I like that one is, if you listen, the Crusaders are the Americommando, Rusty, Fireball, Sparky, and the Barracuda. These are the invaders from Marvel Comics. It's a blatant parallel to them. So it's basically the Freedom Fighters facing off against a team of Marvel superheroes and beating the crap out of them. And they jump out of the pages of an old comic book. I think there was an attempt at doing some kind of like, you know, a parallel tip of the hat pseudo crossover at Marvel too, but I forget it. I don't know if it was as tit for tat as the old Teen Titans and DN Agents thing from the 80s, but nevertheless, a fun piece of Freedom Fighters history where they fight basically Captain America and the invaders. Now, having rambled on for that long about these little pieces of house addery, I cede the floor to my esteemed colleague from Clifton Park, New York.
Another tough issue to find an ad that talked to me. Ended up doing another 2-for-1 cheat of those mini ads on the direct advertising pages. Photo ID card. Works. Guaranteed. Best available. Fast 24-hour service. Sample 25 cents. Cards. Box 1040 NC. Westminster, California. 92683. That right there is a legendary level of vagueness. Step right up for your fake ID, kids. Don't wait until you turn 18 before buying your first six-pack of Schlitz at the Five and Dime. But what ended up being the surprising winner of the two was buy on a canned, lifelike hand that you control. Also earn $$$$. Rush $1.13 stamp, no checks. LOU Box 18741 Fella, PA 19132. What exactly is a buy Onic hand? This is a subtle cash grab aimed at the $6 million man TV show that was on at the time, no doubt. So, you know me, I did some side research, and of course, the internet did not disappoint. Mike Sterling's Progressive Ruin blog from December 13, 2010 jumped right in. How would you make money with it anyway? Hold on, let me untwist that bottle cap for you. One bionically untwisted bottle cap later. That'll be $1.50, please. Or extortion, of course. Give me your money, or you'll get such a bionic tweak. I wonder what this actually was. It was only $1 back in 1977, which I realize is the equivalent of, what, $1,300 today? Well, okay, about $3.50. Which wouldn't cover the cost of much of a toy, even a cheapy plastic one. I suppose you could make money reaching through sewer grates for coins with one of these, which does make me wonder what the make money come on was with this item. Maybe a sheet describing how to market your item for sale, whatever it would be, like the dude that posted this ad did. And I don't know if the whole thing is guaranteed or just the lifelike nature of the bionic hand, excuse me, bionic hand is guaranteed. This hand isn't fleshy to the touch at all, and I find its movement stiff and unnatural. Please return my $1 purchase price at your earliest convenience. No, we are not even pretending to pay attention to phrasing here. On top of all that, what if the bionic hand wasn't in your control? Hey, my bionic hand finally showed up in the mail. Oh God, it's strangling me! This was great.
Yeah, man, shades of the Thing from the Addams Family. And I gotta give you kudos, even though it was just came up in your research. I have been reading the Progressive Ruin blog for like over a decade easily. Mike Sterling's comic blog, it's one of the first, actually probably over 15 years I've been reading, one of the first blogs run by a guy who owns a comic shop that I ever got into. And I still check it every day when I follow the guy on social media. It's I just love that that came up in your research without any prodding from me at all. That is fantastic. So yeah, people, Mike Sterling's Progressive Ruin. Blogging is not dead. You're just not reading any of it. Go follow that freaking blog. All right. So that's the issue. That's the letters. That's the ads. That's all we got, people. Except, of course, we might have something else. We might have a little section called, I Got Any Last Words?
The Deadly Dominoes intro page combo was an absolute freaking win even before Max and I did our second ever full team up. Each successive story wasn't quite as good as the one that preceded it, however, and I had some issues with cover and ads. But we all learned the financial history of Platinum. I kind of wanted to put this one on the bottom half of the pile, but I think I like the whole front half experience so much, I don't think I can. I also started to appreciate the art in the last story more, too. Bottom half of the top half. We are entering a part of the run where we're going to be saying hello or goodbye to creators almost every issue, like this one. So that'll add a touch of spice to upcoming shows as well.
Yeah, after a surprisingly disappointing kickoff by the usual amazing apparel, the first tale won me over in many ways. The second was a fine little two-pager, and the final story practically swept me off my dainty little misshapen feet. It's a seriously enjoyable little comic book, was this. I liked it. So, we'll hit the scuttlebutt, and there's not much scuttlebutt for you here. Just to remind you, go to our awesome Facebook page, the Weird Warriors Podcast Facebook page, run by your buddy, and mine, I guess, Rich over here, providing you an awesome place to hang out and talk about the show, anything related to comics, war comics especially, anything that crosses Rich's frenzied little mind shows up on that Facebook page, and he's there to entertain people. And also remember, if you get so entertained that you want to show a little appreciation for Rich and all the effort he puts into that Facebook page, you can head on over to redbubble.com and you can search for the term, I don't know, Weird Warriors Podcast. And you can put our amazing logo, which was drawn and designed by Bill Walco of the Hero Business and of the Galaxy Gal Kickstarter that probably ended before this episode came out. The multi-talented Bill Walco's logo. And put that on any freaking piece of merchandise you can possibly imagine that you can find on Redbubble. And you can earn a Sam Star for that. I won't make Rich repeat all of what a Sam Star is. You should know by now. And you should also know that Europe is way ahead of the USA in earning these. So get cracking. And that's the scuttlebutt, people. But that's not everything. Now, as I mentioned many times, Rich is a giving person. And he's got one last little thing to give you before we close this episode off. It is a teaser for the next episode.
Weird War Tales 54. I'm 54. If Looks Could Kill. Another awesome intro panel, probably not done by the individual credited in GCD. A new live pet sensation sweeping America. And for the second issue in a row, the WWT premiere of a comics legend. Who the hell could it possibly be? I ain't telling. And hey, vote for your favorite intel report. I can't do all the work around here.
He can come pretty close, folks. Let me tell you. But, you know, I've already pushed him pretty far, so maybe leave him alone, all right? And I cannot wait. I didn't read this teaser before any of you guys heard it. I cannot wait to find out what the new live pet sensation sweeping America is. Those are my favorite ads every time. So I can't wait. So I guess...
Sorry, Max, I already took it.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. I'm just going to be here to enjoy it. That's fine. And, you know, as I wait to find out what the new live pet sensation is, who am I? Who am I while I'm waiting? I'm one of the Weird Warriors. I'm one of the Battling Bros. I'm one of the people on the Weird Warriors podcast where we promise to make war.
No more. We'll be right back.